candidates.
Capital Investment Committee will come to order. Representative Sanstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the minutes from February 18th.
And please look at them in your packets. And are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of accepting the minutes as printed, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are adopted, at least for a while. Okay. First item on tonight's agenda, continuing with the governor's recommendations for bonding projects for the Department of Human Services for us, and this Deputy Commissioner Johnson is here. Thank you for coming, and thank you for accepting the shorter amount of time that was given to you after you were told another number. We have to all be flexible at various times. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services, and I'm very good at speeding up or slowing down as needed, so I'll try to get this into 15 minutes, and we'll move real quickly. These are the bonding projects that the Department of Human Services moved forward in the governor's proposal this year. I appreciate the committee has visited our top two, the St. Peter project, MSOP, and also the Wilmer project. The top priority for our direct care and treatment is the MSOP, the sex offender project in St. Peter. This is a phase two built on a phase one that was funded in 2014. This St. Peter campus for the sex offender program houses a couple of different programs, but the key here is our community preparation services. This is a service that's provided outside of the razor wire for individuals who are on their way to being transitioned to the community. And importantly, the courts are the ones that actually order people into community preparation services. So if you look at the slide, you can see that both moving clients moving into CPS and clients not moving?
No.
Oh. You'll see the clients that are moving into CPS or into provisional discharge have to be ordered by a court to get there. The situation we have right now in CPS is that we have 88 clients who are in the program. We have 42 that are waiting. Those clients who are waiting actually were out of compliance with the law. They should be in the CPS program. So there is some pressure legally in order to make this move. What this does is some renovation on three of our buildings on the lower campus, creating 50 beds of space for sex offenders in this part of the program, as well as recreation and programming space in the Tomlinson building. Along with the $18.2 million cost, this actually covers about $9.5 million deferred maintenance, too, by doing this project, so we kind of get some value out of it in that way, too. The criticality here, and I believe this is the fourth time that we have brought this project forward to get phase two done, really is the pressure that's on the program and the community preparation services, which is a court-ordered service, that we need to provide the space for the individuals who have been ordered to go there. And this would provide us with that space. Second priority in Wilmer is a large motor area for our child and adolescent behavioral health services. You'll recall that this is actually a new building that is in the process of being built. Groundbreaking last year. We expect to open in May or June of this year. This is a service for 16-bed hospital for children with really severe behavioral needs and very challenging circumstances, often trauma or highly complex mental health needs. As a result, one of the pieces that we would like to have as part of making this a complete hospital and really doubling down on the promise that this new building brings us is to have a large motor activity area and an outdoor open area for activity. These are children. They need to move around. They need to burn off energy. We don't really have that space in the project as it's designed now and will open in June. This will provide $1.75 million to support the building of that large motor activity area, as well as a few other pieces of finishing up the project in Wilmer. Our third priority is in Anoka, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. This is the Miller Building. The Miller Building, you can see that home plate-shaped series of buildings. That's where our psychiatric hospital is in Anoka. The Miller Building is an older building that's at the lower part of the screen here. This currently houses some of our administrative functions, as well as a substance use disorder treatment program we call our CARE programs. That program is in space that is really inadequate providing treatment to individuals suffering from substance use disorder. And what we're looking to do with this project is renovate one wing of the Miller Building and move the CARE program, that SUD program, from the wing it's in now into the new renovated wing. And that would provide a more therapeutic space for care of these individuals who are getting treatment for chemical dependency. It also allows us to finish some work that we had bonding for in previous cycles, some HVAC and roof work that needs to be done on the Miller Building, as well as some security work. The HVAC and roof work in particular we can't do in the space we're occupying right now. So by moving this program to the other wing, we'll be able to finish it. That work in both wings of the building. So it allows us to do a little bit of extra work and finish up some work that you had funded in earlier bonding cycles. The fourth priority is asset preservation. Like a lot of organizations, asset preservation is key for us. We have 2.5 million square feet of physical plant that we run within the Department of Human Services. Much of that space is used for care and treatment of individuals who have been civilly committed to us for mental illness, developmental disabilities, or other issues. As such, that space needs to be maintained in a way to meet the clinical needs, to meet the licensing and regulatory needs of that space. The $16 million recommended in the governor's budget will allow us to keep pace with continuing our plan to ensure that our space and our facilities are up to code, up to standards, and we're keeping at least as much as we can ahead of the needs and deferred maintenance currently across our system. Fifth priority is energy system upgrades, again, at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. This is really to develop more renewable energy opportunities within AMRTC. This is something we'd like to do across all of our facilities. We picked Anoka to start with as our first effort. We have about $325,000 per year in costs for electrical costs at AMRTC. So the payback period on this is about a 10-year payback. This would allow some efficiency upgrades, windows, exterior doors, an assessment overall of what we need to do. And then also the way this has been costed is using a solar array to provide renewable energy to support our facility in Anoka. The sixth priority within direct care and treatment is the Cambridge campus. The Cambridge campus is about a 63-acre campus that we have in Cambridge, Minnesota. It has a number of buildings on it, including 8 cottages that were built a little over 20 years ago at this point. We are not currently using this campus. There's one building that we have some administrative staff in. We also have a dental clinic in that building. The rest of the buildings are vacant and are not in use. That has to do, there's a history behind that, the most recent event being a settlement of a lawsuit that told us to shut down the program we had previously been running in Cambridge. We would like to prepare the Cambridge campus for potential transition to some other use by some other party. We don't believe the DHS needs it anymore. This would be some pre-design work to allow us to do the analysis of what we need to do to transition that campus. In particular, the power plant and eliminating the power plant and moving on to municipal utilities, which we believe any other entity using that facility or that campus would want to have. So this is really a small amount of money to get us started down a path that we believe would end with us transitioning this campus over to some other entity for another use. There's been some discussion around potential of housing being here. We call the cottages there kind of look like townhomes and could be used for another purpose, housing other people with disabilities, veterans, other populations. And so we started those conversations working with other agencies around potential future uses. But at this point, DHS does not have a use for it. We're just paying to maintain it, and we believe we should move toward some other future use.
Excuse me on that point, Mr. Johnson. you've had discussions with other agencies, are the peoples in agencies, is there any real interest?
Madam Chair, I think that there is at this point interest. I'm not sure how well formulated it is in terms of there's not an actual plan, which is why I think we'd like to take this time and use these dollars to help us figure out what those uses might be, as well as what we have to do on the campus to prepare it if we're going to transition it. Obviously, we want to involve the community and the city in that conversation as well and what their interest may be either in using it or what uses they'd want to see it for or maybe not for used for. It's actually a really nice campus with some nice buildings on it and should be put to use by someone, but we're not in a position to use it, and we feel we need to start moving toward a new conversation around Cambridge.
And so, Mr. Johnson, does DHS or Department of Human Services make that decision, or do you invite Department of Administration to carry out that function?
Madam Chair, I think the Department of Administration would be very much involved in this if we got to the point of starting to figure out what the next use were and how it got transitioned and following the rules around how state property can be transitioned to another use.
And how long, how many years do you think that would be, or how many bonding bills away is it?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I know the answer to that right now. I think that's partly what we'd learn in this pre-design phase is what other steps we'd need to take to get ourselves there. This is just a first step in moving in that direction.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Number seven is security system upgrades. As I mentioned before, we have 2.5 million square feet. A lot of the programs that we run almost all the programs we run are locked, and many are secure programs. There's a lot of security that goes into that. We have no dedicated funding to go to support security. We got $2.25 million in 2017 for some upgrades at Anoka. This request would allow us to put a new fence in the sex offender program at Moose Lake and also replace about 3,000 cameras across our system and add new cameras to enhance security in some of our facilities where we don't have really adequate cameraing for the current needs and uses of those facilities. So this is really to continue that work to build some consistency in how we put security into our facilities. And finally, Madam Chair and Committee, in a completely different direction, we have a proposal around early childhood facilities. There was a law created, I believe it was 92, that creates this window for the bonding committees or the state to put forward money to communities to use as in developing early childhood facilities. These are really partnerships with communities. There is a 50% local match required in it. This request is both for general obligation bonds and for general fund. The general fund allows more flexibility to be used with non-government entities like childcare centers or other private early childhood programs who have interest in expanding, and given the shortage of childcare across Minnesota, we feel that this would be an opportunity to use some general fund this time around. This is asking for $5 million general fund, $5 million in general obligation. We have the map that we use to show the different sites that have been funded over the course of time. Not every bonding cycle has been money provided into this. It's a grant, competitive grant program, so communities submit grants to us and we evaluate them and make decisions on which ones get funded. As I said, there's a 50% match. So it's a great opportunity for communities who need early childhood space to take an old school or another old building and do some renovation on it, which has been what a lot of the projects have been. Very little building, it's mostly renovation of some sort. This is an example of a facility in the YMCA in Minneapolis and work that was done there a couple years ago to completely renovate that space and build an early childhood program for children in Minneapolis. So we are recommending money there. I know the House has made some recommendations around this in the early childhood bill Representative Pinto is carrying that I think is similar to what's being asked for here. And I think there's probably some interest in figuring out how these things fit together.
When the governor's discussions with the governor taking place, was the $5 million general fund money, is that from the $30 million of the equity monies?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, the $5 million in general fund is just the governor's recommendation of $5 million from the available funding in the state budget. I don't know that it's associated with equity funding. That's not, I've not been in a discussion around that.
Okay, thank you.
And that completes my quick run through of our eight projects. I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that childhood building use, so the community would come with a building that needed some work and you would be a partner in funding the rehabilitation of the building or whatever. Is there any limitation on what type of use, what types of circumstances, who the partners might be, or is it kind of a bake your own cake kind of thing?
Madam Chair and Representative, the partners are usually cities or school districts. That's been historically who's been interested in being part of this. And the statute specifies it has to be used for early childhood programming. I can't recall if it's a lot more specific than that, but that's the nature of what it is.
Thank you.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question is directed more to Mr. Lee, but with the Cambridge campus request, what limitations would there be on the use of that facility or future use of that facility if bonding dollars were used for the planning and design?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative Juergens, the geobond restrictions that would apply to any geobond project would apply to that project. So unfortunately, Ms. Dyson is in another committee, but she could tell you a little bit more clearly. There's the bonds would need to be defeased either through a sale, and basically it is the property has on its deed title that state bond funded property, and that any sale needs to essentially pay back the debt, and I think a few other requirements. So,
thank you. So there would be some strings attached to the future of that property if we were to fund through GO bonds.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
You did really well.
Thank you.
Department of Education. Welcome to our committee. And you know, one of my favorite topics in the whole world is libraries, but I'm going to wait till you give your presentation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Snyder, Deputy Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Department of Education. With me tonight is Jennifer Nelson, State Librarian with the Department of Education. Thank you for giving us time this evening to testify tonight to the bonding recommendation through the Minnesota Department of Education. This is a fairly straightforward and familiar to the members of the committee, particularly you, Madam Chair. The governor and lieutenant governor recommend $2 million in library construction grants. Library construction grants leverage state bond funds with local dollars for renovation, construction, and improvement projects that result in more accessible public library buildings. In addition to ensuring that public library buildings meet the Americans with Disabilities Act, library construction grants result in more sustainable and energy-efficient public library facilities and improve library services. Grants are awarded in consultation with the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. You should have a handout in your packet describing the Thorson Memorial renovation in Elbow Lake, as well as a map of past grantees. Projects may remove architectural barriers from a building, library building or site, remediate conditions hazardous to health or safety, renovate or expand an existing library, or construct a new library. Library construction grants require a one-to-one non-state match and are awarded in amounts of up to $200,000 for library accessibility projects and up to $1 million for new construction or remodeling that includes accessibility. Through 2018, the local dollar to state dollar match has been $7.72. Depending on grant size, 5 to 7 projects are expected to be funded with this funding. Since 1994, 151 projects in 63 counties have been supported. Grants are offered on a competitive basis. However, since this summer, we've had a number of questions about the availability of future grants from Walker, Manoman, Cannon Falls, Mora, Coleraine, La Crescent, Hutchinson, Litchfield, Elbow Lake, Sandstone, and Grand Marais. Thank you for your time tonight.
Ms. Nelson.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Do you have anything to add?
I think the library construction grant is very well appreciated by the library community. There are scarce funds for projects like the ADA accessibility requirements, which you'd think in 2020 might not be as necessary, but we have a lot of older buildings out there that don't have elevators, that have restrooms that aren't accessible. And I think this particular grant program provides a really nice level of state support for the local activities that are happening, particularly in greater Minnesota.
And Ms. Snyder or Ms. Nelson, you give the various, on this fact sheet, you give this, and you say, why $2 million? And you say in past, years, $2 million was, what was, is it just been 10 years that the bonding bill has carried $2 million for the bienniums?
It's,
or each biennium, or each bonding bill, or what was before 10 years ago? How much did they get?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe it was closer to $1 million, $1.5 million. So there's been a slight increase.
And then you went up to $2 million.
Correct.
I keep getting mixed up between millions and billions. Yeah. But now we're stuck at $2 million, even though we know that prices have risen and the cost. Now, the last time I was at the library in Duluth, I was able to tour their brand new public facility, restrooms for the family, for the males, and for the females. And you could walk right off the street into the first thing you saw other than the main checkout counters would be the public restrooms. We didn't have to go down the dark halls, or we didn't have to go up two or three floors to get to these restrooms on main level. And they're beautiful. And I understand that this restroom was under $100,000. And we're very pleased that it's there. But other places must have this, a similar situation in their libraries, because as you said, they're old. And so I don't understand why in House File 2529 that was passed out of this committee last spring, and it was suggested that appropriation be $9 million for libraries. Why the department and the governor decided on going back to $2 million only?
Ms.
Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $2 million comes in part from the criteria under which the funds can be used and the requirements for the grant agreement that are out there. There are very specific requirements in terms of a library that's receiving funds or an entity that's receiving funds has to have 100% of the project cost by the time the grant agreement is written. No activities can be funded unless they happen after the grant agreement is written, so there's a timing issue. We've also found over time that there isn't a need for a lot of large projects, but it's more the smaller projects. I'm hard-pressed to see us being able to have $10 million fully expended by the end of the five-year period that's required by state statute. I would find that somewhat challenging to imagine we could get that much money out, given the maximum grant is $1 million. That's a minimum of 10 grants. With the $2 million, it's usually taken us two grant rounds over 2 years to give out the $2 million. So I agree there is a need out in the community, but just with the parameters of this particular program, I'm not certain that we would be effective in spending those resources during the time frame allowable.
Thank you for that answer. That helps a little bit. But maybe you should think about reviewing the criteria and see if that's it should be more modernized as well. But that's just a thought. And members, in your packet, there is a letter from the Minnesota Library Association that gives an opinion also. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Number three.
All right.
Welcome, Commissioner Schnell.
Thank you. Good evening. Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Schnell from the Commissioner of Corrections. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk tonight. I also want to say thank you for the visit many of the members have made to Faribault on the bonding tour and listening to Warden Anselmo, who talked to you while you were on your ride about the sewer system in Togo. And I also just learning how much the chair likes talking about libraries. I would like to say that we have libraries in every one of our prisons in Minnesota, but I digress.
No, that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. We're very proud of
it. One of the jobs that the inmates have is sometimes working at the library, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Precisely. So before I get into this, I want to just give a little bit of a sense of the DOC. And besides being the third largest agency, we are a 24-hour operation, created in 1959, and since that time, not once, not even for a minute, has the DOC stopped its operations. By the numbers, we run 11 correctional facilities in 10 different locations around our state. We have 53 field offices across the state and jurisdictions where we provide supervision as well. And our capital request is really focused on the facility operations, which I'll talk about in more details. We have four different requests in front of you that total $61.6 million. And we have a little slide problem here. There we go.
Freeman might have had the right idea.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we have our requests are broken into really four buckets. It's number one is asset preservation at $45.5 million, Willow River Communications upgrade at $1.87 million, transportation unit, bus garage and offices at $7 million, and a Faribault building renovation in addition at $7.3 million. When we look at this, the Department of Corrections operates and oversees a total of 11 facilities that contain 325 buildings that total 7.5 million square feet. The age of our facilities range from 30 to 131 years and experiencing different levels of disrepair. While we'd love tonight to be talking to you about capital projects that would advance beneficial needs like family-friendly visiting space, tonight we feel that it's really important that we focus on the areas of greatest need and the greatest of risk. We have 15 buildings at present that are in crisis condition and 59 buildings that are in poor condition. Our deferred maintenance in the Department of Corrections is around $600 million. When we talk about our goals relative to asset preservation, we prioritize issues around safety, and these are our goals. It really is about protecting the state's investment reducing costly repairs in a proactive sort of manner, ensuring compliance with health and safety requirements and regulations, ensuring the safety of those we house in our facilities, our staff and members of the public, and then creating really good environmental safety, heating, ventilation, and electrical systems. When we think about this is an example. We have the deferred maintenance really speaks to the fact that public safety and safety of our facilities becomes our most important feature. And you can see a couple of the examples of the deteriorating windows, and this is in our living units at some of our facilities. These are, in fact, incredibly high priority. A utility tunnel that is failing, and we had to put temporary supports in as an example of what we're talking about when we look at asset preservation, along with things like fire suppression and leaking roofs and the sewage system, replacing doors that are more than 50 years old and furnaces that we can't get parts for anymore. When we look at asset preservation, we know that we had many different projects to bring you, but we wanted to bring a reasonable request. We focused on urgency and the prioritization of those urgent needs accordingly. We list them out by virtue of life, health, and safety code compliance. This is really hazardous materials, abatement, OSHA compliance, and security systems. Next is heating, ventilation, and cooling, and HVAC replacements. And then finally, building envelope, such as roofs, walls, foundations, and window replacement and repairs that are important not just to our staff and resident safety, but the safety of our visitors as well. And finally, we really need to give attention to the mechanical and plumbing needs that we have in our facilities. Just some of this you've seen, and you can see the pictures of things that we think are important for people to be aware of. That when we talk about these requests, which we know are big dollars, it's important that the public understand, because oftentimes the public doesn't get the opportunity to get into the secure areas of the correctional facilities. And I think this gives a sense of the condition of these important public assets. When we think about our population, we think it just gives you a sense of what causes the wear and tear on these facilities. On a daily basis, we operate in such a way that we're really at capacity and have been at capacity on any given day. You can see in 2017, we had we had 10,000 people in our prisons, and with a capacity of 9,522 beds. Today we really run right at and around that 9,500 people on any given day. And really today, one of the projects that we have that's actively being worked on today is the fire suppression system in St. Cloud. That some early work is being done on that, and so we are moving people out into other facilities while we do that work. In addition, you can see that we do have projected growth. And we bring this up only because we think it relates oftentimes to some of the policy discussions we're having with other committees here. While we know that we need to take care of these assets, and while we expect some growth over the course of time, we're really mindful about the fact that we want to take pressure off our facilities by making sure that we're managing population as best we can. So let's talk a little bit just really quickly about some of these projects. The project priority number two is the Willow River Communications System, and this is really an investment in the Armor radio system, and it affects the safety of this facility because they have challenges in terms of communicating even within and among facility staff. So such things like man down emergency buttons are hard to access, and we oftentimes cannot get access to the radio to be able to communicate. And more recently, we had a situation where an ambulance came, and normally we'd like to be able to communicate with them as they're coming in to respond to the needs of one of the residents at the facility, but couldn't do that because of radio failure. This is a key and we think a core public safety, a tool that has to be there for the safety of our staff and really for the safety of the people that we house. Being able to communicate with our partners in public safety is critical. Third priority is a transportation garage. The Department of Corrections really spends, we transport about 1,000 people a month across our state. That doesn't count the number of transports that we do across our country. We house our fleet vehicles in three different locations. These are makeshift locations and less than ideally secure. We believe that we can consolidate these facilities, bring all of our equipment into one place so that we can more efficiently manage it and secure it. And ultimately ensure its operation. We also we lease a space right now for our large transport buses, which are on the road and literally we put tens of thousands of miles, almost 100,000 miles a year on these buses in any given year. To make sure that they're fully operational and that they're secure, we'd like to have them in a place where they can be managed, and we stand the possibility of losing a lease that we currently have where that facility is housed, or that the buses are housed. We also recently had a situation where some of our transportation vehicles were vandalized. We had a catalytic converter cut out of one of our transport vehicles, which impacted our operations for that day. So it speaks to the importance of this goal.
Commissioner, before you get off this.
Yeah.
Refresh our minds again. We talked about this a little bit on the tour. And refresh our mind where these three locations are. And
so we store
how
some.
How they got. Why there's more of a need now for them to be secure.
Madam Chair, some of our vehicles are actually held at central office. They are outside, so they are right out in the elements. The second one is that we secure some of them at Oak Park Heights. We have a smaller unit, and then third, we lease a space from the city of Bayport that the city uses. And that's the one that we stand the chance the city is interested in using that site, and we would lose that, and we would hate to have these buses, which I would add are not your typical buses. We spend about $750,000 on each of those buses, and we have two new buses coming in. So making sure that they're secured in a place, it becomes important for the safety of our staff, and then really the safety of the public as we transport people around our state.
And so how many vehicles are in your fleet?
We have more than 400 vehicles fleet-wide, but the number of transport vehicles, there's two large buses, there's a number of smaller vans, we have SUVs that transport, because we're transporting people from court on different types of writs. We're moving them between facilities. So they're even the hospital. So there's a lot of vehicles, and that transportation unit is moving people all the time.
And these three points are all in the metro area? Or these?
Madam Chair, that's correct. They're all in the metro area. So we centralize a lot of that here, and they go out from here. And then the fourth item is the Faribault facility, which you've seen. This really is the building that we saw. We lost a lot of our facade came down, and this speaks to kind of some of that enveloping that they talked about, that the experts talk about, and making sure that the water damage and that we're addressing it. This building becomes really important to us. As we think about and look at, and in the coming weeks, we're going to be hearing more about facilities. Over the last several months, we've been looking at the use of our facilities. For instance, Stillwater, as you all know, much older building, over 100 years old. It is not the most ideal place to secure higher risk inmates, and right now that is the second highest. We have the most secure is Oak Park Heights. Both Stillwater and Rush City provide close custody, and Stillwater is one of the most well-known because it's local. Rush City is a new facility, or newer, one of our newest. And when we think about how to secure people at this higher custody classification level, we begin to add the question, should we be looking at moving higher risk people to Faribault, for instance, because we have direct observation facilities? And so as we think about the ways that we create more safety for our staff, make more safety for the people who live in our facilities, and have really critical and key programming space, because I think at the end of the day, we recognize that we have to be able to do things with these folks while they're in our care, custody, and control that ultimately allows them to be better off when they come out. That is in the public's best interest. This building renovation and upgrade addresses a whole number of things. It provides for both hazardous material abatement, demolition of some of that that facade stuff and rebuilding of that. And then it creates a number of programming space that could be used for treatment, that can be used for education, religious services, transition services, offender representative space where we can bring those people together, safety and security, the ability to provide for more modern supervision of programming space. All of these things we believe can be built into that facility. And as we look at the long-term use of Faribault and its space and the more current or updated facilities, we think this investment becomes key and critical to addressing the broad and long-range safety and security needs that the department has. And then finally, I would just say this. Madam Chair, you had raised when we had the opportunity to talk, unrelated directly to our ask, but one of the things that at some point in time we would like to talk about is the fact that more and more counties across our state are being put in a position where they have to build new correctional facilities. And I think ultimately many of these communities are struggling and looking for ways to fund those operations and maybe ultimately coming to the state. And as we look at this, we want to assure you and those communities across our state that we're very mindful of the burden that these capital projects put on local counties. And really, we want to partner with them to talk about the most effective and efficient ways to do that going forward. And I just thought it was important to mention that, as many of you may hear from constituents about the fact that the DOC, as the regulatory body, is requiring replacement or upgrading of facilities at considerable cost to local counties. And so we want to make sure that you know that we're very mindful of that. And are beginning to have conversations with counties that are broader about how to meet these demands that local counties have and think about them in a ways that counties can support that in the long haul.
Thank you for addressing that. I really appreciate it because that's a question I've been asking the other agencies also. Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Commissioner. Can you just talk a little bit about the Togo Sewer Project? I know you mentioned it at the opening statement of your presentation, but just the need for it. And then under the priorities that you've identified, can you tell me where that project falls?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. It is an asset preservation project, so it's in that $45 million bucket. And it is among the top priorities because that project, that just interesting history, that sewer was hand dug by then youthful offenders that were placed at Togo, there's been nothing done to it since. That sewer system is leaching now into really some very beautiful area, and there's lakes not far from there. And we think that this is critical that this get addressed so that it does not have a bigger environmental impact, and that it gets upgraded because it's an incredible place, we would hate to really cause harm environmentally with this system.
And Commissioner, there's a river there too, isn't there?
Madam Chair, I believe there is, yes.
Very beautiful.
Thank you.
Representative Lehman.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just can't resist because you offered that comment about helping local communities with their new correctional facilities. And I know that Chair Murphy is concerned about this. When we say how much of the need are we actually imposing one agency, you know, on another, and because we're asking counties or telling counties really that you need to build a new jail, new correctional facilities. And I know I'm faced with my circumstance at Itasca County, and I have to commend your department's really working hand in hand with Itasca County, really in a positive way. But we're talking, you know, $60-70 million. And so, and we're in a county where our tax revenue, property tax revenue, has been declining because we're losing, you know, paper companies are going to court and decreasing their, and our Minnesota Power and others, our big taxpayers are going to court and reducing their taxes. Right. And so at the same time now, we have to increase property taxes. So I'm going to the legislature and I'm asking for local sales tax up for the county for the first time ever to pay back the bonds that they're going to have to sell to do this. So my question, I don't want to go on and on and on, but at the same time, my city is also going for a local sales tax option to pay for their bonding project. But so I'm just interested in hearing what some of your solutions might be. Right now, I know the Department of Corrections gives counties a deadline, a sunset. You have to, by, in our case, it's September 2021, have this well on its way or done, or we're not going to cover you. You're on your own. So what kind of ideas do you have? Do you have any ideas on how you can provide relief to local communities?
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, thank you. I've gotten a lot of these calls from county commissioners. First of all, I think we have an obligation by statute to make sure that folks are compliant with all of the regulations that exist, and nobody, I think, disagrees with any of that. I think when we start to having these conversations, as we think about what's the best way to solve some of the problems that we have in corrections and the challenges that ultimately certainly the same taxpayers are going to be asked to kind of support some of these projects. Mm-hmm. How do we ultimately build facilities that meet multiple needs? Are there ways, whether it's even thinking differently about the fact, does every county need to have its own jail? Can they share, even get on borders or boundaries? Can they build smaller facilities by sharing some options and saving costs? Because it is staggering when you talk about those dollars and just the annual cost of payment on those bonds. And I think, you know, even in talking about us, when we think about one replacing one prison like a Stillwater, we cost our state between $300 and $600 million to build. It's massive dollars, and that's from on a state level, and I can't imagine I know the impact on a county level is significant. But we think that it's high time for us to think, because the burden we cannot continue to ask people to continue to do this. How do we ultimately meet the needs of local communities and our state by not growing the pie, but really thinking about how we cut that pie and how we work together on an intergovernmental basis to do that? How do we meet needs not every county or even the state can provide? And think about ways that we collaborate. And I think there is opportunities. It's not easy because it's never as convenient as being able to take them right into, you know, your county seat. But there is opportunity there, and as hard as that is.
Okay. But, Madam Chair, if I could just close here and just say thank you for that. And I would encourage you, one way might be to provide some flexibility on those deadlines. You know, they're just scrambling right now to look at options. So that might be one option.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I was remiss to say this. We will always work with somebody. We're not going to, unless we get to the point where there is absolute fundamental life safety issues, we are not going to just close things down. But we, what ends up happening is we found, and in many cases we understand, this is the one, really one of the last places that oftentimes that we want to spend money. And it's easy, I think, to let that go. And ultimately, we have to get to a place where we move them there. And we've been working with one county for 15 years to try and get there. So, we may have to restrict some programming options or some certain types of people that can be held there. But we want to work with people to get them to the point of addressing the need that does exist.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're so good at answering these things and thinking, and I haven't given you any warning on this question at all, but you started it by saying you have a $600 million deferred maintenance. So if we do their 1, 2, 3, 4, and you said that you were bringing us a reasonable package. You use that word reasonable. But I see that you still have then $548 million in deferred maintenance. How is that reasonable?
Madam Chair, that you are right. That's an unfair question. I'm just kidding.
But it's one question that I'm going to be asking.
We're
going to be discussing in here because for the first time ever that I've been associated with this place, we have the opportunity to be bold and step forward and put some new money into trying to cut back on these deferred maintenance kind of things that have been accumulating year after year after year. I'm not saying we should always have a bonding bill of $3.5 billion and $700 million in cash. In addition, I'm not saying we should do that every year, but MMBs come before this committee 3, 4, 5 times to tell us we could safely do that investment, and then we would cut down far below the 500 and whatever number I had said. And it seems to me it's more reasonable to use that money in a bold effort of investment to offer some of our state agencies the ability to get rid of some of this climbing deferred maintenance. And I did this kind of so I could explode here, but I thought you were a friendly face that would.
Madam Chair, I'm grateful that you exploded. I am. I have a list here that I think to your point. Frankly, it's somewhat embarrassing that we kick the can down the road on so many of the things that are really critical, and I think it does become a challenge, and we want to be reasonable and balanced, and yet I can't disagree that, you know, if we want good outcomes, we have to take care of the stuff we have. And frankly, I think when we look at some of the facilities that the state has, we have exercised. This state, I think, has done some things that have been pretty remarkable. Look at St. Cloud and Stillwater, buildings over 100 years old that have gotten an immense level of life and, frankly, still have a lot of life. But to your point, we have to, must. It's critical that we not continue to kick the can down the road and we begin to invest in saying, if we're going to keep these at a much lower cost than spending a $500 million or on building one brand new prison, then we really have to make sure that we go deep in this investment. And we I will tell you, we do have a list that would cover exactly what you're talking about by way of priority, but we had to start by being where we are. And Madam Chair, I would just say that in a very short period of time, we could come back to this committee with a much deeper list if that was something that you and certainly our governor would give us the authority to do.
spoken to him. He might.
Oh, thank you.
And I've spoken to some of my committee members. And I just have to speak to a few more. And they might, too. It's our opportunity. We haven't had an opportunity like that. Just like we didn't have an opportunity in the 90s to offer the state secure regional juvenile facilities in the 1990s. And then we did by doing something bold, by offering a partnership across the 8 congressional districts. And each one had the opportunity to join together in a plan. And these other things that grew up. And Togo, how many different sites has or programming has Togo had over the year and is still a place that has to be repaired so we can give it another new mission?
Yeah.
So you're doing great. So thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? I'll go back and be calm now for the rest of the time.
Thank you, Madam Chair of the Committee. I appreciate it.
Uses a word like reasonableness. Okay, Representative Pearson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I applaud your vision and certainly anticipated it. You know, I guess I just would put a little bit of the brakes on it and calm the waters a little bit by reminding people that we are in a workforce shortage also. We do talk about how low interest rates are and how that's fantastic for the private sector and the public sector if we're able to borrow and do this type of investment. This infusion of bonding dollars would be a huge improvement. But with the workforce shortage, that means some of those bids are going to be going up. And when those bids go up, we aren't getting as much bang for our buck as what we once thought. And that impact isn't just here in the Minnesota state spending. It's for our private sector as well, because when we're competing with those exact same contractors, we do have those challenges. So, you know, I believe in this bonding bill. I'm excited for the final bill that will be passed. I just want to, you know, make sure we're aware that some of the numbers that are thrown out sometimes are maybe would have some negative consequences also.
I appreciate your comments, Representative Pearson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next. Commissioner Anderson Kelleher, welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. That was an impassioned discussion. I hope you'll look at this big ship, Madam Chair, and take a deep breath. I know you like those big ships. So, I am here to present the governor's recommendation on transportation. And I do have a few slides here. I'm going to try to go as quickly as possible, but I suspect that there will probably be a few questions along the way. And we'll start with kind of what our goals we had in mind as we put together this proposal. Our first goal is to ensure the traveling public is safe and that family members, community, and friends are able to connect safely every single day on the system. We are also addressing system stewardship and asset management through this proposal, and improving community health and environmental sustainability. The governor has recommended $451 million of overall capital investments in the transportation system this year. The breakout is $280 million in general obligation bonds, $2 million in general fund cash, and I'll get to why that is, and then a little over $168 million in trunk highway bonds. So I'm not going to go through each of these because I have a slide on every single area for you, and it's a good way for you to keep track of the recommendation on that particular sheet. So we're going to start with rail grade separation projects at $110 million of trunk highway bonds. These are rail grade separations that exist on the state trunk highway system, thus they're trunk highway eligible. The rail grade crossing and rail safety study identified over $150 million in priority rail grade separations. The photos that you're looking at are Trunk Highway 47 and Ferry Street in Anoka. The $110 million in trunk highway bonds will construct the rail grade separations, including bridges and underpasses at rail lines. We've seen an increased volume over the last number of years in vehicle and pedestrian safety concerns at rail grade crossings. And crossings actually may exceed 19,000 vehicles in one day and 45 trains. So without good rail grade separations, this is kind of a recipe for an eventual disaster on the system. The two rail grade crossings that could be funded through this amount, Madam Chair, are the Moorhead Crossing at $62 million and the Anoka crossing at $45 million. These are the number one and number two most dangerous rail crossings in the state. So in priority order, we would put that together. Another big focus of the governor's bill is the local road system. So this is the local bridge replacement program. The recommendation is at $112 million in general obligation bonds. These have to be general obligation bonds because they are not on the trunk highway system. There are over 950 bridges identified on the local system as high priority for replacement. This set of photos is actually from our MnDOT Bridge Structure and Inspection Program Manual. The total cost for this replacement, if we did all of those bridges in today's dollars, is $436 million. So that gives you a sense of how far we would get in being able to make a dent in that backlog. The average cost of replacing a bridge is about $430,000. There are some large bridges out on the local system that need replacement. An example of that would be the Kellogg Bridge in St. Paul, is one of those bridges that's in need of replacement in the near future. I have a number of examples of previous types of bridges that have been funded through the program. It is a competitive process to go through, but we do know that there is a great demand. Another part of the funding, yes, Madam Chair.
The roads that you have a list,
yes,
of bridges that have to be replaced,
yes,
and they get replaced in cycles, right? When their numbers come up, kind of.
So, Madam Chair, there's two parts of this. One is the state system, and we have a priority order for the state road and bridge system. And generally speaking, our bridges on the state system are in a little better shape than the local system because of the 2008 investment that focused on bridges, that had a heavy focus on bridges. The local road system, we do have the list as well. but this is an application process. So the local community also has to put in some dollars usually, because the program doesn't pay for things like right away or the approaches. Or if the community decides they want to do something other than the standard replacement of the bridge, they usually need to put in some more resources into it. So it's a little bit difficult to say exactly who and in what order those projects will come, but we have heard from communities about what their needs are. Does that help?
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. 112 million GO bonds, and then the Kellogg Bridge, which is about 50 million. Are you including that in the 112 million?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, we fully expect that the City of St. Paul would apply for the funds. Under the way the current program is structured, they would be eligible for a little over $45 million of those dollars. There could certainly, up to the legislature's discretion and the governor's, there could be some other costs included for the City of St. Paul in that. We would strongly prefer that the legislature does not earmark any dollars in the bill for any particular program. But at a Madam Chair, at 112, it would be able to cover that cost and more.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Kelleher. Well, I'm on record of wanting to help out the St. Paul Bridge, but we may have to use a little discretion on how we do this. But through the process, I think that'll be worked out. Going back briefly to the railroad grade separation, it was Anoka, and what was the other one?
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, Moorhead.
Okay. Well, those are, you know, two large cities taking up almost all the money in railroad grade separation. We have a lot of needs across the state of Minnesota for other railroad grade separations, and I think we need to take a strong look at those too. I know there's one at in Glenwood that we did fund most of, and now they find themselves a few million dollars short. So there are some that we need to finish, and some others that are in great need of being done. So again, using a little discretion through the process, I think we may have to look at that too.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, I have more on railroads coming, so that may also address some of those issues. I do want to point out that those two projects are on the trunk highway system, and they have a high volume of cars and trains every single day. So that is why they are lifted up in this proposal. Madam Chair, the next issue that we cover is local road improvement program, a very popular program at MnDOT. Again, it is an application program. In 2017, we received 217 applications totaling a need of $580 million. We were able to award 36 projects at $25.4 million. So showing that there is quite a hunger for local road improvements out there, and we believe that this is a very good investment. These pictures are all from the local road system, showing both conditions and some of the challenges that local communities are facing right now. And Madam Chair, I think you know this, that if we do not provide this sort of opportunity, property taxpayers will pay more. Or communities seek other options to be able to pay for their local roads, like local option sales tax and other things. We have a high priority in this program on road safety, as well as being able to prevent rural fatalities. 46% of our nation's highway fatalities take place on rural highways when only 19% of the population lives rural. And so we think that this is one of the stronger cases for why focusing on the traveler's safety is so important. And this money also helps supplement, like I said, the local effort and highway user funds, especially where systems interconnect, we can do even more. We also have responsibility for Greater Minnesota Transit, both in operations and in capital investment. And we are actually seeing a real increase in people wanting to have good rural transit. So in these pictures, what you're going to see here is Moorhead is the pink bus, Pipestone is the folks who are a little bit older getting off that bus, Isanti is the kids on the bus, and Rochester is the buses in traffic. And so this proposal of $10 million will help a number of communities be able to make investments. Again, the need is greater than what the dollars are at $42 million. And a little further on this, so the funds are for rural transit in populations less than 50,000, small urban systems, fixed routes, populations 50 to 200,000. And one of the other things I want to say, this is an important part of reducing greenhouse gases in Minnesota. We've focused a lot on types of engines, the electrification of the fleet, biofuels are key, but right after that is actually the use of transit options, biking, walking, and an increase in that by 2050 to be able to reduce the transportation sector's greenhouse gases. We also have airports. Other than MSP Airport, as I think many of you are aware, We have the governor's recommended $19.2 million in GO bonds, and that will be focused on three projects. There's projects throughout the state, but I want to highlight three today: International Falls and the runway reconstruction, Brainerd Aircraft Rescue and Firefighting Building, and Rochester Runway Reconstruction and Safety Improvements. And these are important for not only the traveling public, but also critical to public safety. A lot of medical transport goes in and out of these airports, and so having them be in good shape is very important. We're getting to more railroads. Railroad grade crossing warning devices, $6 million in general obligation bonds. Over 750 aging signal systems across the state. Our calculation is that it'll take $200 million over time to replace them all. We want to continue to do work on this system. We have to work with our partners at the railroads to get that done. It is a high priority that these sorts of systems save lives. Just today in Brown County, we had a train propane truck crash outside of Sleepy Eye with a fire. People are okay, but this is the sort of thing that with better warning systems can be prevented. About $300,000 per location. One of our more popular things that we have been doing and very important is the Safe Routes to School program through our Office of Transit and Active Living. Safe Routes to School helps local communities both plan and then complete projects that help students, staff, community members be able to safely go to and from a school site. In this proposal, we have $8 million recommended by the governor for NGO bonds, $2 million in general funds. And the reason for that is that we actually have identified Native American populations as populations who walk and have more crash incidents with cars as pedestrians. And one way to help reduce that is to do more work on with tribal communities to be able to do better planning. And so we believe, and it also is, there are some reasons for that high rate of walking. There's low car ownership on many reservations, and so we think that this is an important piece. In our strategic planning document, Minnesota Walks, the statewide plan identifies Native Americans as a high priority population, and that includes new sidewalks, bicycle trails, ADA improvements, and pedestrian signals and crosswalks, and that would go across the whole program. We feel quite strongly that this is both an important program for health, and as many school districts have cut busing services, students have to commute either by foot or by bike a much longer distance. And so keeping them safe and having that ability. We also have deferred maintenance on our own system in terms of the buildings. And so I just want to share with you that in a study with the Department of Administration, our current deferred maintenance in buildings is $187 million. Over half of our truck stations are 30 years old. Many of them have kind of outdated facilities to them. And so this $58.8 million of trunk highway bonds, because this is directly related to supporting the trunk highway system, that's why trunk highway bonds are available to us, will really prioritize things like better facilities, ADA compliance, energy reduction, being able to have more standardized specs as we build out and replace the system. Lots of times we have made do with what we can find. And that can be, that's a great thing to be frugal, but at times when those buildings age, it really, they show their wear. And so this is a priority. Of our buildings, we have 20 buildings that are rated as crisis or emergency, 56 that are rated poor, 260 that are rated fair, 418 rated good, and we have only 134 rated in the excellent category after our study. And we certainly could supply that study to the committee if that's helpful. The next program is for the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program. This is $5 million in general obligation bonds. This helps what are commonly known as the short line railroads around Minnesota. Often those railroads that are carrying the short line roads, loads of grain and other commodities between one place and another. And we had in 2018 nine applications that were awarded $1.5 million in grants. We believe that when we last solicited, there was a need of over $4.5 million in this area. And I'm going to keep going for you. The Port Development Assistance Program. There are a number of public ports, and this program supports those public ports in Minnesota. I know that many of you were on the mini session and saw the Port of Winona. I know that many of you have visited Duluth and seen the Port of Duluth. These public ports have prioritized $30 to $40 million in project needs. The governor's recommending $10 million. We actually really look to the Port Association to help us with this proposal, and they were quite helpful this year. It does not obviously fill the whole need that is out there right now. The ports are also important in our greenhouse gas reductions. Trucks emit about 371% more carbon than inland barges, and rail emits 39% more. So the ports and the barges really do help us meet those greenhouse gas emissions, and we see this as one of the things that's going to keep growing. So these dollars would help St. Paul. I want to go back for a second to that picture. The one that you can see, I think, on your upper left that looks pretty dilapidated is the St. Paul damage that was done in flooding. Winona, Red Wing, and Duluth this time around. The governor is also recommending $10 million in general obligation bonds for the passenger rail service. And this is, at this time, really focused on that second train to Chicago. And I think many of you saw that, a presentation on that in Winona. It would, the train would originate here and would go to Chicago. It cuts off those delays that happen with the train coming from the west. And it also gives a complete loop for the traveler who wants to go to Chicago for business for the day and come back in the day. I know many of our smaller communities where air service is not readily available are very excited about this. Wisconsin has also identified $10 million in state funds to continue work on this project. There had been a time when Wisconsin wasn't as supportive, and Wisconsin is now back really in the game on passenger rail, and that makes this quite attractive to be moving forward. So, Madam Chair, I think I have come to the end of my presentation. I'm going to take us back to that long list in the beginning, and if there are questions that I can answer or phone a friend, I will do that.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emission and when you're considering all of these projects. And I have a question with you, for you regarding the local bridge program and the for the local bridge program, just in the sense that we have seen a need of $436 million, but you're requesting only $112. Can you just walk us through how did you come up with that number, and also if we were able to fund at that request, how many of the 456 or the 950 bridges will we be able to address?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Lee, I'm going to have Mr. Rudin join me up here as we talk about this. Again, just to remind everyone, these are programs where communities are going to have to apply, and so we don't always know exactly what size of project we're going to get into the program, and so it may be a little difficult to say exactly what number we would get to.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MDOT Government Affairs. And the 436 projects are what we are on what we call the priority list. And so these are projects that we know that are coming in the near term. The projects on the waiting list are projects that have their plans completed. They're ready to go. All they need is funding. And so the funding that the governor is recommending would allow us to get to those projects. The 436 projects, you know, assuming there is another bonding bill next year or the year after, you know, those projects would be completed over the next upcoming years. But they, not all of those projects are necessarily ready to go today.
And Madam Chair, if I could add, Representative Lee, that in 2017, the amount in this line item of general obligation bonds was just a little under $50 million. And that two of the bridges that were done out of that, one was the City of Minneapolis 10th Avenue Bridge, which is in process right now. It's going to start soon. And then City of Isle Malone Island Bridge, which was actually the bridge that's on the slide. That was a much smaller bridge, a little under $1 million, to give you the sense of range.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm going to ask about a specific one. This is in avoidance of earmarking, because this is a pseudo earmark. We have a traffic buildup problem as our community is growing faster than anybody could pay for the roads to go around. And what's happening is the traffic is ignoring us, and they're deciding to go down the roads and create extraordinarily dangerous things. And maybe you're aware and have seen the intersection of 14 and 104, the county road 104. The county is really prepared to move forward on this and to be significant partners in it. But oftentimes, and I've been over to District 6 more than once discussing this sort of thing, and we always run into what I consider at that point to become arbitrary and capricious issues. You can't do that because it's not in our 10-year plan. I don't care. The public didn't come and talk to me about a 10-year plan when they decided to flood the intersection with three buses, two gravel trucks, and a streaming bunch of cars going down the road 70 miles an hour. In the middle of that, people are trying to go across the road and go through the road and go turn in the intersections. The public honestly doesn't care about the 10-year plan or about the 20-year plan or about the 5-year plan. They are driving down that road, and what the county is coming to the point is this needs to be fixed irregardless of somebody's, as I said, arbitrary and capricious statement of we haven't had it on our books. I'm pretty sure that that could get planned in less than 5 years. So there it is. You can decide how you want to answer.
Commissioner Anderson Kelleher.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Sock, I was taken to that intersection by the district engineer, Mark Schoenfelder, and we sat there and watched traffic for about a half an hour one day. And I will say that I think, and I've seen some video as well of people doing some unwise turning. And so I think the department is quite aware of the county's need in that section. I think one of the challenging situations, as you're well aware, is we are trying to streamline the Byron stoplight situation as well. And on Highway 14, that has been a high priority as well to identify which of the stoplights could be removed there. So there's a little bit of conflict about what comes next, but I am most certain that should the legislature's will and the governor sign a bill, we would be prepared to work with the county on delivery of the project. Madam Chair, it is not our preference to earmark projects. I just have to repeat that again and again, because there is, as you can see, there is quite a backlog already in the system. However, there are times when communities are in a growth mode or something develops where there needs to be interaction that puts a project higher on the list.
Follow up, Representative.
Just one more comment. I hope I had been heard to say that the city is and county are well prepared to actually participate in that intersection, not just expect somebody else to do all the work.
Madam Chair, Representative Sock, I have spoken to county leaders, city leaders, and okay. I'm aware.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Anderson Keller. Two things. First of all, I'm assuming you haven't had a chance to testify before the Senate yet, or have you? Capital investment.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, I have not been before the Senate this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please be sure to express your distaste for earmarks when you talk to them. thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
You have, Commissioner, $168+ million requested in trunk highway bonds. Now, I know of other requests that are not included in this for trunk highway bonds. I think Henderson has a situation there where they need that. 212, another need for trunk highway bonds. Do you have a ceiling on the amount of trunk highway bonds that you would accept in a bill?
So, Madam Chair, and Representative Erdahl and members of the committee, it is a critical point for us to tell you that we have an internal debt policy to not exceed 20% of our annual budget on debt payment. We are approaching that very, very closely. If the governor's recommendation, and then, you know, I As a student of this process, having participated in it in the past, I suspect there may even be some other things included. And that will put us very, very close in 2025 to the 20%. We'll be probably just a hair under it at about 17.5 to 18%. And that gets to the larger question, which I know you are the Capital Investment Committee, but that will get to the larger question in next year's legislative session of the need for some sort of comprehensive sustainable funding bill to help pay down that debt and be able to move forward with the rest of the project. So I appreciate the question. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
So you're saying there's a little bit of space there?
Just a little bit.
All right.
Representative Stanstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. Really what I want to do is just put in a plug and thank you for what you're doing for Greater Minnesota. It's too bad that Representative Lehman isn't here because I think she would probably echo many of my sentiments here. We are seeing some opportunities in Greater Minnesota, but it's limited. I would urge you to expand what you can. Especially of existing, you know, services, maybe additional hours of service. As you know, and we've been in contact a couple of different times, we had a program, Rural Rides, which came to an abrupt halt, and it leaves a hole in a cell of our community for people with disabilities that where they had the opportunity to leave the house, where they had the opportunity to contribute to the workforce, now they can't. Now it's solely on them independently to find a solution. I have one constituent who is blind and has a traumatic brain injury from an accident. And what limited service was there was taken away with the loss of that program. And now the question is, now what do I do? Do I draw on the system to support me where I used to contribute? And I'm not advocating for one individual per se, but that's a reality across Greater Minnesota. And I want to make sure that, you know, Minnesotans have opportunities to be gainfully employed, to contribute, to have meaning, to have value. And transportation is so critical. So I just want to urge you to look at expanding that. And if you have creative ideas, come see me, because it's a real need for my area.
Madam Chair, just briefly, I want to say that Representative Sandsteed brings up a very good point, and one of the things that our Office of Transit and Active Transit is doing is people are now working in a more regional way to address issues about where jobs are, to where the transit is going. And it doesn't give you immediate relief for that constituent by any means, but the idea here is to build a better system in rural Minnesota of transit, because there are people who are transit dependent in rural Minnesota, and we need to be providing better service.
Representative Considine.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I really wasn't planning on speaking until everybody started plugging their own. We had three more fatal accidents on Highway 14, three more deaths this year, and I don't see any earmarks for 14 in there, and that's frankly very disturbing.
Madam Chair, every single day of my life I think about Highway 14, and I think Representative Considine knows why. Yeah. I lost my cousin on that highway on a section that has been improved, and that was when I was 14 years old, and I've never forgotten that. I think about the people who died recently on that highway every day, and I am working with the governor to try to bring options. We are going to submit an infra grant to the federal government in the next week or so here for the Highway 14 project. There's a stronger focus on rural roads in this round of infra. we also are working on a number of other options. I think the important part here is we need to get that road complete. And so that is a high, high priority. I also want to go back to what Representative Erdahl said about Henderson and the flooding there. And there is another round of funding coming from the federal government on the build grant. We submitted a number of projects, including Highway 14, in the fall. We were not successful. We did not receive one single grant federally. I believe that we have been able to enhance our applications, and build is going to be coming available again. We are likely to submit a portfolio of flood-related projects, and we believe that Henderson will be in that round of funding that we're going to seek. So we should work closely together as you're putting the bill together. We don't know if we will have the answer, but we also want to use the dollars wisely. Another reason, maybe not to earmark, Madam Chair, is to give maximum flexibility to the department depending on those federal funds available.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try not to drag this on too long. This is my second committee meeting of the evening, yeah. So it's, you know, it's just like we go all day and
this
all night.
This is more exciting than the other one.
Perhaps. Yeah. Perhaps. We'll find out. Well, first I would share Representative Considine's sentiments. We don't agree on everything, but we certainly do agree on Highway 14. And I think, you know, as I've watched this develop over time, it seems that the improvements we made from Mankato to Nicollet were great, but they also kind of pushed the safety issue down the road, so to speak. Completing that four-lane section meant that which really had the worst safety record, we improved that dramatically, but it kind of moves that safety issue just further down the road towards the city of New Ulm. So while I applaud the department's efforts to access federal funds, the information I've gotten indicates that the odds of getting those funds are very slim. There were, I believe, nearly 1,000 applications nationwide for the Build Grant program. In the last round of those 1,000 or so applications, just over 200 were even considered, made the level where they could be considered, and out of those that were considered, I think only 40 or so, I don't remember the exact numbers, they're coming off the top of my head, but it's not a lot. Not a lot make it across the finish line, so I think we need to focus our attention and our efforts on our resources we have here in Minnesota. As far as trunk highway bonds go, do we know how much I'm sure you do know, or somebody knows, how many projects we've committed to that have not been funded because they're not ready yet?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, I hear you on Highway 14, and I just want to say it again. We are throwing every single bit of effort that we have. I drove the section last year with District Engineer Aus, and we, stopped along the way, took a look at where the particular sections are, where the community is in agreement right now about what to have happen, and that's the good news here. Madam Chair, I just want to mention one other thing. I think someone's coming to maybe help me on this. I know it's in our forecast booklet, so I'll let Mr. Rudin look for it. But I want to say one other thing about one of the largest challenges that MnDOT has had. I've been commissioner for a year, and I've been seeing a lot of the projects that are coming through that were funded in different ways. Either there might have been a Quarters of Commerce project or some other program. One of the bigger challenges we have is when the rest of the funding is not identified for the project. Highway 14, Madam Chair, is a project that largely has almost everything identified and is ready to go. But one of the dangers in earmarking projects that someone may tell you is a great idea is that we may not have the funds for a number of years to complete that project. And that's another reason to be very thoughtful about that. I think Mr. Rudin's ready.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson. I think if we understood your question correctly, is how many bonds have been authorized but have not yet been sold?
Yes.
There's $1.195 billion that is remaining to be sold.
Of trunk highway bonds?
Correct.
And how far out do you anticipate that those projects stretch before those bonds are authorized?
Madam Chair, if we
just
could
an estimate. I don't need an exact
budget,
number.
It's person come down.
It's a significant amount of time, I think.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Josh Knetter-Hubinger, Budget Director. Representative Torkelson, the current forecast is out through fiscal year 25 mm-hmm. for this $1.2 billion.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind.
Please.
So we do not, you know, in our GO bonds, we have a time limit of 4 years. If the project's not in motion, we have to either extend it or cancel it. But we don't have that same process in our trunk highway bonds. Is that correct?
But I thought you had five.
Well, I may have my numbers wrong. It's late, Madam Chair, you know, but I think it's four.
It's not late yet.
It's only
quarter after eight. Josh, I didn't get your last name.
Again, for the record, Josh Knetter-Hubinger from MnDOT. To your question, Representative Torkelson, the same rules apply, but the trigger doesn't start until the year the pot of money is authorized, and large portions of those available funds are authorized out through fiscal year 24. So that's why it's so delayed. So that recent $400 million of quarters of commerce that was approved in 2018 is actually spread out over 22, 23, 24 for
and,
availability.
I'm going to ask Ms. Dyson about the 4 or 5 years, isn't it?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, it is now 4 years. There was a few years ago the statute was amended where it kind of alternated between being 4 and 5 years because of how when a bill was enacted, but now it's just 4 years from the enactment is the time allowed for encumbering the money.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Encumbering is the word.
So along these same lines, we've been authorizing projects that are out in the future ways. And it looks like, Madam Chair, like Ms. Dyson might want to add something to her remarks.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, if I understand, Mr. Lee was reminding me of that. I think with regard to trunk highway bonds, it spells out in the enabling legislation when the bonds are actually going to be authorized, and the cancellation statute is matched to the schedule that's put in there. So there was a whole lot of money authorized, but it says the cancellation statute doesn't kick in until a certain point for different amounts of money. So it's sort of built into the mm-hmm. rider language, and that mm-hmm. we haven't done that with the general obligation bonds. It's just the 4 years.
Thank you.
Okay.
And at this point, Madam Chair, if I may, I'll go back to my line of questions for the department. Is that all right?
That's all right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the other question I have regarding these projects that have been set up for some time in the future, it seems from what I've been learning that they're inflating in cost. Can you make some remarks regarding that and tell me how we're going to handle that issue?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, it is true that in the area of highway and road construction, we have been facing and often face a higher level of inflation than the general public does. So the construction cost index it runs higher than the regular inflationary index. However, recently on projects, although I did get some good news today, I think my second project as commissioner came in a little bit under budget, which is amazing, because most projects right now are running anywhere. We had a spike last year of somewhere around 30%, which we think was an anomaly based on labor, based on supplies, based on a number of things. And so we do not anticipate it's going to be that high, but it is true that we are facing a fairly high inflationary index on road construction right now. There's also been, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, since you and I worked together on these issues a few years ago, there's also been quite massive consolidation in the industry, and that means there's less competition out there for these projects.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
But also, it's my understanding that in some of these projects, that especially corridors of commerce projects, the scope of the project was incomplete when it was put on the list of priority list for corridors. And as we fleshed out those projects, we're realizing, or you are realizing, that there's a lot more work that really needs to be part of the project. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, one of the issues that we have run into on a number of the Corridors of Commerce projects are that because of the way those projects came to us, they are good ideas, but they often were not scoped. And I have to say, this is where the 5- and 10-year plan are helpful, because those projects go through a really rigorous process of their initial construction estimate, and then going through that MnDOT process of figuring out what they're going to cost. In the case of Corridors of Commerce, we've run into projects that didn't consider drainage when they were proposed at all. And as you are well aware, with the amount of rain that we're having and other things, and when you put down more pavement out there or a different type of pavement, you're going to have some significant effects. So, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, you are correct. And I think we have now developed a small graph that I'd like to share with you. I don't have it here tonight, that can illustrate this quite quickly to anyone who looks at it.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I think it's something we need to consider. There's quite a bit of talk around us legislators about taking a look at corridors, and if corridors is going to continue, how we might improve on the process. Just one final, little bit more detailed question regarding the Henderson situation. I know that in the Red River Valley, we have used DNR's flood mitigation funds quite extensively to work with the projects regarding flood mitigation, including road, I believe including road reconstruction. I haven't had a chance to look back at those projects to see what dollars were used for what, but are we looking at that combination for the Henderson project?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Anderson Kelleher.
Representative Torkelson, yes, flood mitigation monies are one of the things we are actively looking at for the Henderson project. I believe possibly the Albert Lee project. There are a number of flood situations where a combination of dollars might be effective.
Representative Torkelson.
Just a final comment. Thank you for that, Commissioner. That would at least slightly reduce the strain on our trunk highway bond allotment.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And last week, I asked a question about Henderson of the DNR and flood mitigation, and later received an email from them saying that wasn't their purview. That's all up to MnDOT.
Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I think that Representative Torkelson, in your memory, and probably Madam Chair's memory, of things that we did in the Red River Valley are important to return to here.
Yes, thank you. I'm just conveying an email that I received last week.
Representative Sanston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, earlier in your presentation, you made the comment about sometimes funds aren't available to complete projects that are started. Following that thread of conversation, how does a project get completed? So, as you know, there's one hanging out in my district that is over 20 years in the making, and it frustrates me that we invest money and we're in the queue and we start and we're following the rules and we're going down the pike and everything is there, and then you fall off and it's like you're forgotten. and the need hasn't gone away, and it has become more expensive. And it goes back to promises made, promises kept. So how do those get completed?
Commissioner.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Sandsteed, and to the members of the committee, I think, you know, the lessons of Highway 14 and Highway 169 of Highway 23 are very important here, because we rarely have enough funds to go into the entire corridor and redo it all at once. And so the ability to make logical sections of that are important. Now, I know Senator Tomasoni spoke to me about this last night as well. I knew that we were going to be having this conversation today. I think that it is really important to be thinking about next year's comprehensive transportation bill as we prepare for that.
Madam Chair, that's not an answer that's going to work with my constituency. They want to hear something other than, oh, you're kicking the can down the road to another year. So, and I understand none of this happened under your purview. I understand that. What is reasonable as we look at projects? Do we put a 10-year, like, do we bind the hands of the government and say, you have 10 years to complete this project? If we're going to fund it, we're going to see it through. And maybe you don't do it all at once, but the expectation is that it is done to completion, not halfway done. And again, it comes down to the value of investing dollars. We want to be wise. We are charged. It is our responsibility to be wise in doing that. And again, we're so far down the road on some of these projects, and the cost now has, I don't even know, tripled, quadrupled, 10 times as much? I'm not even sure. It's a lot more. So what is the appropriate answer other than, well, let's look to next year and hope we have a transportation bill? That didn't work last year, and I really am not going to hold my breath that it's going to work next year. We don't know what the condition of our state will look like in a year. So what is reasonable? What's the win for the state, and what's the win for the communities that are depending on this?
Madam Chair, Representative Sandsteed, the win would be more funding to be able to get these projects done. We don't have, I just told you, we are at nearly our debt capacity. We cannot go higher than that debt capacity. We are going to hit the fiscal cliff in transportation. The need is an $18 billion. That's with a B, billion-dollar need. Your really important 169 project is part of that need. And so I so wish that I had the ability and the way to get these projects done with you right now. But without that additional funding, I can't answer to you to say this is what we can expect, because right now it's a grim transportation funding future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for your patience this evening, and we've gone a little bit over because we don't usually get the opportunity to have the Commissioner come with all these good answers and so forth. Oh, I guess I have one more. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, nice to see you. It was an honor to serve underneath you when you were here, and I think you're doing a good job. So I represent some East Metro communities, and you've really, you and your team, I think, have really stepped up. And, you know, over on 694, there was some issues. It would have been hugely expensive to redo the intersection, but I think your team came up with some really good ideas to redo the intersection, and we're really creative. We also have had deaths on Highway 36 here, and where people, I'm sure you heard about in the news, where someone was driving a big truck and decided to check a text or something. And but you know, these things happen, and it's sad. And I really believe your team's working on it. Thank you for the economic development money that shows up, and that's going to help on a project I think that we all visited on Manning. Mm-hmm. You helped a couple years ago with the Hadley intersection, and I think that's really turned out well. I think MnDOT really tries to make it so that the flow of traffic continues. We've seen extreme changes with the new bridge at Stillwater, but I think that economic development really helps, and hopefully we can push Manning over the top. We visited that. That was one of the stops in the capital investment tour, but no, I realize, I'm glad you brought up the $18 million because I was here when we did the gas tax, for example, and with indexing and inflation, you know, with inflation, that's, I understand that's basically gone. That 5 cents is just really doesn't exist anymore. And I mean, it's just one example of what we do here in this building. And, you know, it takes investment, and we all need to do a robust bill. I would argue we need to do a bill every year, you know, and kind of change the formula and not do every other year. But we have capacity as a state to be able to afford to do these things. And it's good to hear the story of 14, 23, 169, and I-36. And I'm sure there's dangers in Minneapolis and beyond. But, you know, we need to pass a good bill for all of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Lilly. I'll just close by saying this. I actually enjoyed coming before you today, and the reason I enjoyed coming before you is that often I don't get to talk with some of you about what the need is. And so to be able, on behalf of the governor's recommendation today and the partnership that we have, to be able to show what the needs are, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
I do, Madam Chair. You know, we've been dancing around this conversation here for a while this evening. I have said for a long time that we need to pass a significant transportation bill every biennium, and when we don't, we fall behind all the other budget areas in state government. We have had one bill in the last 10 or so years that added substantial funds to the transportation budget, and that was my bill.
Yes.
When Democrats had complete control of this legislature, they didn't raise the gas tax.
Yep.
And that's the facts.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have to say that I've spent my summer thanking Representative Torkelson, Senator Newman, Senator Gazelka for their work on getting those funds to from the general fund to transportation. I know that that wasn't directed at me. So I want to just say that transportation deeply appreciates what has happened, and we do need to kind of normalize transportation investment again in the process. So any opportunity to discuss that with you is something I want to do.
And Commissioner, it's our opportunity to talk about the bonding bill, the transportation bonding bill, as well as the transportation bill. And we have to go hand in hand, and we have to work together. The one bill has to complement the other and not substitute for. And if we get that settled too, we will be doing well. And just, it is my hope that at another time or when we're working together closely on some of these changes that you mentioned earlier, that you might visit with the governor again about the Port Development Fund and about the second or the train to Chicago and coming from Chicago. And wouldn't it be wonderful if the people that got off the train in Minneapolis could get on another train and get to Superior and to Duluth. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's next bill. That's the next year's bill. So, Commissioner, Administration. Roberts Davis. You've been so patient. We don't get transportation stuff that we all know so much about because we all have roads and bridges and things that need repair and so forth. And so we've got oodles of questions. Now you're going to have it a lot easier. Okay. Yeah, she's got one thing in there that we might have to talk about. But she's prepared. And she doesn't even know us.
Good evening, Chair Murphy and members. Thank you for the opportunity to share the projects that Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan have recommended for our agency in their local jobs and projects plan. Just a little background on the Department of Administration. We have a wide-ranging set of responsibilities that ultimately touch every area of state government. I am so proud of all of the work that the 25 divisions of admin do, but for the purposes of our discussion tonight, I'll highlight just a couple of them. Our Facilities Management Division is responsible for maintenance and operations of 23 state-owned buildings on the Capitol Complex. You'll likely see these team members as they clean your offices, repair this building, and show up at all hours to shovel the snow. Admin also oversees the construction and leasing of buildings across all of state government through our Real Estate and Construction Services Division. We manage more than 400 construction projects and 800 property leases annually and are also responsible for long-term planning. In addition to overseeing construction and repairs, admin coordinates consistent data collection on the condition and needs of state facilities through the Enterprise Real Property Program. This program allows us to have a full view of the condition and needs of state facilities and maximize resources to support property management. Finally, our Office of Enterprise Sustainability, or OES, leads the effort to meet Governor Walz's ambitious goals in Executive Order 1927 to make the operations of state government more sustainable. I'd like to start with a broad overview of our recommended projects. Our top priority is the restoration of the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account, or CAPRA. I'll share more details about that shortly. Next, we'll focus on investing in the future of the Capitol Complex to better meet the needs of state government. And finally, these projects present an opportunity to address Minnesotans' increasing interest in taking on climate change. Here you see an overview of our recommended projects. You can see they total $32.8 million, of which $13.5 million comes from the general fund. I'll talk about each project in a little more detail. First, the governor recommends $10 million in general obligation bonds to restore CAPRA, the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. CAPRA funds emergency repairs and hazardous materials abatement for state agencies. This program ensures state facilities which experience unanticipated emergencies are operational again quickly and that construction projects are not unduly delayed if hazardous materials are discovered. $10 million represents a significant investment in CAPRA, but it's sorely needed as this account is currently completely exhausted. This amount represents the total appropriations from the 2017 and 2018 sessions. Demand for these emergency funds have grown due to the increasing age of state facilities and the limited funding for preventative maintenance. Recent uses of CAPRA include repair of a broken water main at the Minneapolis Veterans Home, chiller, window replacement, mold abatement, and reconstruction at the IRRRB offices in Chisholm, and repair of exterior walls and roof at the student housing dorm at the Perpich Center. At the master scale building, CAPRA allowed for mechanical and plumbing repairs that avoided a disruption to the Department of Commerce's work. This is one of only 10 master scales in the entire country that can be used for weighing international and interstate shipping. Many farmers in this region used us for weighing grain shipments, and if it were not functioning, then they would have to ship their products to Chicago or Montana, which are the closest master scales. The photo on the right is from the Ag Health Lab building where CAPRA funds were used to address the significantly deteriorating ductwork, serving lab facilities and other critical needs to ensure safety of the building occupants and the continuity of lab operations. The lack of available CAPRA funds represents a significant risk to state government. we will be left unable to respond to resolve any emergency with CAPR funds through the winter and spring. And this is really the most critical time for CAPR funds as we experience freezing and thaws, rain, tornadoes. We see an increase in the use. A failure to fund CAPR will leave agencies with no choice except to divert their operating funds to these maintenance issues. I can't overemphasize the importance of funding for CAPR to be included in this year's bill. The governor recommends $1.5 million from the general fund for a new real estate strategic plan. This is required by state law and is also simply smart planning. The document will provide a foundation for decisions related to building, owning, and leasing facilities for government operations. The plan will also include stakeholder input beyond admin and agency perspectives, including the legislature, Capital Area Architectural Planning Board, and other stakeholders. The state drafted its last strategic plan in 1993. It was updated in 1995. That's been more than 25 years ago, and the current strategic plan has been substantially implemented and lacks information on how to accommodate a modern workforce. It's no longer helpful for us in making leasing versus own decisions, informing our building locations, and agency co-location opportunities. I'd like to point out the map on the right of the slide that shows the transit vision from the 1993 plan. You will appreciate that the author's inspiration for this plan showed the light rail line that would go to an underground stop in the middle of the Lower Town Mall before heading to the Kelly Inn. Kelly Inn's been updated. Maybe the plan should be updated too. The operations of state government have changed significantly since 1993, and an updated plan is really needed to best meet the needs of state government. The governor recommends $5 million from the general fund to capitalize a revolving loan fund to finance energy efficiency and water conservation improvements in state facilities throughout Minnesota. 31 other states have a similar plan that they're benefiting from. The funds will be administered by Admin's Office of Enterprise Sustainability. All cabinet-level agencies will be eligible to apply for funds, and requests will be reviewed by the Office of Enterprise Sustainability and then recommended for approval to the Department of Administration's Commissioner, the Commissioner of MMB, and the Pollution Control Agency. Loan recipient agencies will enter into an interagency loan agreement with the OES, and they will be responsible for repaying the loan over a term of 7 years. Possible building investments would include converting interior or exterior lighting to LED. You can see that that's what's happening in the photo there at Camp Ripley. It would allow for digital controls for heating and cooling, and then low flow fixtures and toilets, just as examples. From their work with agencies, OES is confident that there are numerous opportunities to make improvements in state facilities, but availability of funds remains the key obstacle. In our recently released Enterprise Sustainability Annual Report, agencies identified a lack of available funds as a barrier to implementing their already identified quick win projects. Agencies rightfully prioritize their operating funds to their core mission, even though sustainability investments would be helpful with them improving their costs over the long term. This investment offers a clear and affordable step toward the energy and water conservation goals in Executive Order 1927, but beyond its sustainability benefits, it presents a well-established opportunity to make our operations more efficient. The governor recommends $2.6 million from general obligation bonds to acquire land on the Capitol complex. A privately owned parcel is available for sale. It's surrounded by state-owned lot AA near the southwest corner of Rice Street and University Avenue. The parcel would be combined with lot AA for parking in the short term and then be available to meet future development needs as one of the last viable parcels for new construction on the Capitol complex. The acquisition will provide an additional 45 stalls with room for green space and help temporarily ease the strain on Capitol complex parking. In the long term, this acquisition would allow the state to control the site for future development needs on the Capitol complex. The governor recommends $1.7 million from general obligation bonds to demolish the Ford building and prepare the site for redevelopment.
This includes removing all of the hazardous materials and stabilizing the site with landscaping features until authorization and funding for a replacement building are obtained. The Ford building is located on the Capitol Complex on University Avenue, just east of Rice Street. It was acquired by the state in the late 1960s and repurposed for office space. It's been vacant since 2004 due to the deterioration and need for major repairs. The vacant building is located on prime real estate across from the light rail station. The average annual cost for upkeep of this vacant building is $71,000 and is expected to climb. Vacant buildings also create safety and security threats, and the upkeep of this building has already accrued about $1 million in taxpayer debt. A recent facility assessment report notes that the building envelope stabilization project is required, and that's expected to cost nearly $300,000. Recently, the National Park Service also took a rare step by rejecting this building for the National Historic Register of Historic Places after finding the building no longer retains significant historic integrity. The overwhelming majority of projects that are brought forward to the register are approved. This one was not. Its current dilapidated condition and building layout do not make the Ford building a good candidate for restoration. With renovation, the building would accommodate roughly 200 state employees, while a new building could accommodate 900 state employees that are not currently located on the Capitol Complex. And we know that there is a high level of interest from agencies to be on the Capitol Complex. In addition, we believe that restoration costs would result in prohibitively high lease rates per square foot. The governor recommends $5 million from each of the general obligation bonds and the general fund to continue to implement the security upgrades identified in the 2013 physical security study. These recommendations also come from the Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security. This photo shows the new turnstiles and security kiosks in the administration building, which were made possible by a portion of the $10 million appropriation in 2018 to begin implementing the study's recommendations. While this funding has allowed for progress across the Capitol complex, considerable vulnerabilities remain, and a general fund appropriation will be needed to secure buildings not eligible for bond-funded upgrades. Consequently, without this appropriation, over half of the identified Capitol complex population and building square footage will not receive the security upgrades necessary to improve the safety and security of employees and visitors on the Capitol complex. The governor recommends $2 million from the general fund to establish a centralized funding source to correct physical barriers in state-owned and state-leased buildings in order to improve physical access to state services and employment opportunities. These funds will be available for use by state agencies, boards, commissions, legislative and judicial branches of government, and constitutional offices. The funds could be used to improve or add signage, reduce changes in elevations, modify fixtures and break rooms, restrooms, and shower facilities, or modify conference rooms and auditorium seating. The Minnesota Council on Disability will review each request and make recommendations to admin. Our Real Estate and Construction Services Division will manage the fund and deliver the construction improvements. By improving the physical access to state government facilities, this program will also improve the independence and productivity of Minnesotans living with disabilities. The final project I'd like to talk about is one in which admin has a role, but you heard about from the Pollution Control Agency last week. It's for electric vehicle charging infrastructure. As part of the larger PCA project, Governor recommends $2 million from appropriation bonds for admin to help build out the state's electrical charging infrastructure on state-owned property. These funds will be used to install 13 fast DC charging stations and approximately 100 level 2 charging stations across Minnesota. These stations will accommodate the state fleet and public-owned electric vehicles. To accommodate the charging needs of new fleet vehicles across the state, new charging stations and electrical infrastructure will need to be installed at public facilities. By building out the statewide charging infrastructure, we will also encourage the general public to purchase electric or hybrid vehicles because more charging stations will enable these vehicles to travel longer distances. We've already identified 13 locations for the new fast DC chargers. The locations are in state-owned facilities, most of which are open and accessible to the public, including the Capitol complex. If fleet vehicles were not using the station, the chargers would be available to the public for a small fee. locations for the level two chargers would be determined in the future. So this concludes our recommended items in the local jobs and project plan. As you're well on your way through agency overviews, I know the committee has expressed an interest in the bigger picture of state facilities and the need for continued investment in asset preservation. Admin is the home of the Enterprise Real Property Program, which coordinates the data related to state-owned properties across the entire enterprise. Our data says that for state agencies alone, we're approaching nearly $1 billion in deferred maintenance, with over $2 billion needed over the next decade to renew or replace building systems. A failure to invest this year will exacerbate these needs. As you can see in this figure, capital budgets over the last decade have failed to properly invest in asset preservation. We know costs increase as building conditions deteriorate, making investment in asset preservation a fiscally responsible choice. Total asset preservation and HEPA appropriations have considerably lagged behind requests. And the 2020 session, as you so eloquently stated earlier, Chair Murphy, is really a huge opportunity for us to begin to clear the backlog of deferred maintenance across the state.
Thank you. Representing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for Commissioner. As I'm looking at the list of requested projects, I have a question about the Building Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund. We know that from time to time buildings need their roofs redone. Does this fund allow the possibility of installation of solar as part of, say, a roof repair or something of that nature? I mean, you can only replace so many LED lights. You can only replace so many light switches. You can only replace so many faucets and toilets. And I'm just curious, is it very, very confined, or is there a little latitude that will allow the state in some of those facilities? And I always say it in conjunction with the repairs or re-roofing that a project may need to be done.
Chair Murphy, Representative Dean. This fund is really intended for much smaller projects. Solar would not be included. The payback on these projects is up to 7 years, and a solar project would take much longer to repay. And so we're really looking at those more quick win projects that, that agencies can do and receive a payoff in a shorter period of time.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I certainly understand that, although I do know with the cost of solar coming down, that we're starting to look at possibly less than 10 years on a payback for solar. So just something to think about as the future as you consider the strategic plan, maybe. Thank you.
Commissioner, tomorrow we're going to hear from the Department of Commerce on the guaranteed energy savings. Do you work with them for your buildings?
Chair Murphy.
With the Department of Commerce on that idea?
Yes, we do, Chair Murphy. Yes.
So you're familiar with it and all that?
I am, thank you.
And yes. Does the other agencies that you talk with all the time, are they aware of the Commerce Guaranteed Energy Savings Program?
Chair Murphy, yes, I believe that they are.
All right, thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. On the same program, too, one of your talking points is saying that there's a lack of funding. Can you let us know what is the total funding request that the other agencies have with regards to this Building Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund? Will the $5 million in requests fulfill that need, or what is the actual number for us?
Chair Murphy, Representative Lee, I don't know that I have an actual number for the number of requests that are out there. We would propose an application process where agencies would apply to the Department of Administration's Office of Enterprise Sustainability. They would go through those applications and then determine which projects should move forward. Until we go through that process, I don't know what the actual demand is, but we know that agencies would like to make these improvements in their building, but when they're forced to choose between operating their operating budgets or making these sustainability improvements, they choose the operating budget.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what is preventing them from submitting those applications right now or their plans for improvement then?
Representative, I'm sorry, Chair Murphy, Representative Lee, the funding is not available at this point in time, and so until we have that pool of money that would be, again, revolving, so as an agency realizes their savings, they would be repaying the Office of Enterprise Sustainability, the Department of Administration, then we could loan the money out to the next agency that has a project in mind. The governor's proposal establishes the program itself.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. We have recently concluded a very massive restoration of our capital at a cost of, I think, at least $310 million at the end. Now, is there a fund contemplated or being established to address the long-term preventative maintenance that is needed? You know, I see you have the capital asset preservation replacement account, but it seems that that's, you know, emergency funds. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the need to replace a pipe that suddenly bursts or something, but over time, a crack becomes bigger and bigger, and frankly, this wasn't addressed until it became of a critical nature. And is there a plan to address this before it reaches a crisis?
Commissioner.
Chair Murphy, Representative Erdahl, the in lieu of rent fund is what's used for maintaining the capital, and so those funds are given to the Department of Administration for the purpose of maintaining the capital and other ceremonial spaces and others that are occupied by tenants across the Capitol complex.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. And Commissioner, and how much is in that fund?
Chair Murphy, I might have to phone a friend. I'm not sure how much is in lieu of rent. Chair Murphy, Representative Erdahl, I'm hearing $2 million, roughly.
You think that's enough?
Chair Murphy, Representative Erdahl, we've been able to maintain the building successfully with the in lieu of rent budget. We've gotten incremental increases over recent years, but overall we are able to maintain the building with that fund.
All right, thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of going past my 9 o'clock curfew, I'm going to ask one more question.
You haven't asked any on this commission.
I know, that's why. Now, I'm going to go back to the electric charging stations. And my question, you may not be able to answer, maybe for PCA, but I understand, you know, we're installing some of these stations in various locations for the very relatively small number of electric cars that are on the roads today. Mm-hmm. What is our long-range plan there? Do we intend to still, is the public going to supply charging stations en masse, or is this going to become a private enterprise in time? Is there a plan?
Representative, Chair Murphy, Representative Torkelson, there is a plan for state government as far as how we want to build out the infrastructure. I know that private industry is also working on plan, but it's kind of a chicken and egg scenario. If we don't have the charging stations, people don't buy the electric and the hybrid vehicles, and so we're trying to get ahead of the demand and encourage people to purchase the vehicles because they have the ability to travel long distances with the charging stations that are conveniently located along the highways.
Thank you.
Representative Sanchez.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A little off topic, but not completely. Charging stations. What is the average cost of a charging station, and what's the life expectancy of a charging station? Chair Murphy.
Mr. Roberts Davis.
Representative, I'm going to have to ask an expert on this one as well.
And Madam Chair, if they want to get back to us, that's fine.
I have an expert here. I think we can get the.
We might as well hear.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening, Ann Hunt. I'm the director of the Office of Enterprise Sustainability at the Department of Admin. So, Chair Murphy and Representative, it does vary widely. We're proposing for the state agencies that would have 13 fast chargers that we would locate at public facilities that the state owns. So, for example, one location would be at the MnDOT Brainerd rest stop area. And so what the chicken and egg problem is, we have some agencies that aren't able or aren't willing to get the electric vehicles because they're not confident they're going to have locations to charge. The DC fast chargers are approximately, I hate to say a number, approximately about $80,000 to do those. The level two chargers will differ and roughly in the $7,000 to $10,000 range. It really depends on how much infrastructure you have to put in. If a facility has, for example, with the level twos, 220 power there already, then that is a lower cost. And if you don't have to dig up concrete and have a big long run. So, you know, on average, it'd be in the $7,000 to $8,000 range. But as I said, it really does vary by the circumstances and the conditions of the locations.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. And then do you have a life expectancy of a unit?
Good questions. That the that's why we're going to go with the appropriation bonds, because the infrastructure will last, the conduit in the infrastructure will last 20 years. The charging stations may be more at a 10-year life. So that was why they weren't eligible for a general obligation bond.
So
the actual charging station. But it's a combination of two things, that you're doing both the infrastructure and the actual piece of equipment.
So is there a plan that people have to use their credit card to get charged, right?
Primarily the ones that we're proposing in admin are going to be for fleet vehicles. But they would be available for the general public as well, so that we've cited them. And yes, there would be a charge that they would put on their charge card or on another charging. Some of them have their own kind of apps and other things.
Oh yeah, those apps.
I know.
Really. So does the money then that comes in from the charges that you sell go into a pot of money to go into the next charging station or replacement?
Chairman Murphy, yes, that would be the intent. It would stay with that, you know, that facility.
Thank you.
It's a whole new world. A whole new world. But let's go back to the old world.
Thought we might.
What date did you say that the state acquired the Ford building?
Chair Murphy, in the 1960s.
Who did we acquire it from?
Chair Murphy, that's a great question. I don't know that I know the answer to that.
Well, you can get back.
From the federal government is what I'm hearing.
And then you're going to, that you're, so we're going from the 200 employees that could be in there to 900 employees in a new building.
That's correct.
How high would that building be?
I believe that it's four stories, Chair Murphy.
Yeah. It goes right, way up to the next street up then?
It would actually fairly good coverage of the entire site. Right now, the site is not being completely utilized, so you'd look at a much larger footprint for the building.
And do you plan that there would be a ramp in that building in addition to the 900 employees, parking ramp for cars?
Yes, Chair Murphy, it would accommodate about 450 parking stalls.
Any green space?
Yes, there would be green space as well.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoy your brisk evening.
Tomorrow morning's meeting will start at 8 o'clock. This meeting is adjourned.